So they are in their dinner break right now. Hadar Avaram is a professor of law at the University of California, Hastings College of the Law, where she co-directs the Hastings Institute for Criminal Justice and publishes the California Correctional Crisis blog. Her latest book is called Yesterday's Monsters, The Manson Family Cases and the Illusion of Parole. And that book is just out. And how about a little free promo here? Hadar, are you going to be speaking around the Bay Area about this book?
Yes, there's going to be a big book release party at Manny's on 16th and Valencia on March 11th. It's going to be a Wednesday night at 7 p.m. at Manny's, and everybody's invited, free admission. We're going to talk about parole in California, why it's broken, what to do to fix it. Please come in your thousands and bring friends.
Okay, well, I'll give you a chance to give those details again by the end of our broadcast, about an hour from now. So, Hadar, when they go on these breaks, and as we've talked about, during the trial, or even at the beginning of each day, the sergeant at arms for the Senate goes to the podium, goes to the dais, and kind of orders that if anyone is talking, if anyone is not here in their seat, they will be arrested, which is pretty wild. Nobody has been arrested, and I doubt anybody actually would be. But what happens when they have these breaks is a lot of lawmakers then rush out of the chamber and they go straight to the cameras, straight to the reporters to give them something you would not get out of a real jury, right? But that's what they do. They go straight to the press and make their statements. Let's hear what some of them have to say, and I want to know get your reaction to it, Hadar. First, we're going to begin with Republican Senator Mike Brown of Indiana.
You know, we've seen this before, so I think that they believe that by repackaging it, remarketing it, you know, we'll find something different, and I haven't seen it, so.
Well, it's interesting you say remarketing it, but Senator Kennedy said last night he was learning a lot of new things. Do you get the sense, a bunch of fellow senators?
I think it would, and that could be, if you've been paying attention to it in detail along the way, I didn't see one thing in terms of their visual aids that, you know, wouldn't have been up on the screen during the hearings in the House. Did you guys? I have not. I think that the big thing I want to see that's new is the defense's case. And I think that all of this you got to kind of put on hold until you see what they're going to do with theirs. And clearly we won't see that until Saturday. So,
what is it possibly convincing you from new witnesses?
So then it boils down to, in my mind, was there a quid pro quo? And, you know, I don't think that's what they're trying to prove here. But when you look at the components of it, the aid was eventually released, correct? And the investigation was never held. The meeting was held, even though it wasn't at the Oval Office, it was, you know, at the UN. And the idea of pressure and the one fact witness, which would be the president of Ukraine, said he wasn't unduly pressured. So when you're doing this in the context of an impeachment inquiry that now has turned into an impeachment and a trial, we're left with the decision, does it warrant the death sentence, which Nikki Haley tabbed it, you know, in terms of removing somebody from office. And I don't think that case has been made. And it won't be made unless, there's something else that comes up, and I don't see where that's going to happen.
That's Republican Senator Mike Brown of Indiana speaking to reporters just after the break began for dinner from the Senate trial. Hadar Avaram, I noticed you shaking your head as we were listening to that clip.
There's really nothing new here. These are the same talking points that Devin Nunes and others have made throughout the impeachment inquiry. There was no quid pro quo. The aid was finally released. This is, by the way, a complete misunderstanding of how the law of attempt works, but okay. So we're basically just hearing things again and again and again. There's a very thin veneer here of the idea that there's actually people sitting on the edge of their seat trying to figure out if there's new evidence. I mean, that's not really what's going on. Again, the cameras are not showing you how many people are not even present in the room, which kind of tells you that if the sergeant at arms actually were to arrest people that get off their seats, they would have to chase a lot of Republicans to put them back in their seats. So there's a lot of that. The one nugget here that I think maybe holds a little bit of interest is the idea that we have to listen for the defense. And it might be interesting to see what they put together, like what arguments are actually made here against impeachment that are not just these yelling Fox News talking points, which is why anyone who can stomach it should stay and continue to listen to this, because It's going to be intriguing to see what they come up with.
I almost wonder if we'd be better served to have half the day the floor managers and then the other half of the day the defense, rather than three straight days from one and then three straight days from the other.
Possibly, but of course that would serve the purpose of the defense. And by the way, this brings me to another point that we haven't really talked about, and that's what the Chief Justice is actually doing here.
Yeah.
So presumably the idea of how to run the trial is something that John Roberts would, you know, preside over and have some say in. So far, he's been doing precious nothing. He's not policing people coming in and out. He's not making any statements about witnesses. Keep in mind that the role of a judge in an actual criminal trial or even a civil trial is much more extended. It's true that the judge does make the decisions of guilty or not guilty because the judge essentially lets the jury, that's the jury's decision.
Right.
But a judge makes a lot of really important decisions about what kind of evidence comes in and what kind of evidence lets out. Even if whatever Chief Justice Roberts proposes can be basically done away with by Mitch McConnell and a majority of senators, it is still worth making those points, if only for the purpose of trying to introduce some due process into the situation.
That's right, because if you want to introduce a witness or introduce any kind of a motion, you would begin by doing that with the Chief Justice, who would, I guess, make a ruling. If the Senate, if Mitch McConnell doesn't like it and if he has the votes, they can undo that ruling. They could reverse his decision. But the first line is actually with John Roberts. I mean, oftentimes when we've talked about a Senate trial, we've talked about the Chief Justice of not really having a substantial role because it's the Chief Justice is only implementing the rules of the Senate, which is true, but he actually does have a significant role.
Right.
If he chooses to turn it into a significant role.
Sure, sure. And we have to keep in mind that this is a bit of a delicate situation because to run into a situation where he, as a representative of the judicial branch, is now sort of running afoul of what the legislative branch is doing is also, you know, perhaps he thinks not a good look. It's anyone's guess what he thinks, but it seems that he's sort of capitulated to the idea that he's just there to just sit there in his robe and there isn't even an effort to have any input about what kind of evidence gets in, what kind of evidence gets out. Maybe some concern about a situation where he sort of presses for more evidence to be heard and then Mitch McConnell pushes back and it's not a good look for anyone. Maybe that's part of what's going on, but it's pretty clear that there's been that he perceives his role as being purely ceremonial.
And it's interesting because John Roberts is, I don't think anyone would argue otherwise, is considered to be a conservative justice on the Supreme Court. But at the same time, seems to have made a space for himself to also be seen somewhat more independent on the court as well. He was the one justice who kept Obamacare in place. He was he has rebuked Donald Trump several times in statements from the court, like in the annual statements, things that rebuked what Donald Trump has said about the courts itself, has even defended the courts against Donald Trump. And it would really create, I mean, if you want to make sure you have a legitimate process, right? That is the role that he could serve. And it would create really interesting politics that if he was more active and committed to trying to make it a legitimate trial, if he had to continually be overturned by the Republicans in the Senate, wouldn't be a good look for them in that. But I wonder is he then in a sense playing politics himself by not asserting himself more?
I mean, it would be naive to assume that courts are not political actors. We know that courts are political actors just in the same way that the legislature and the executive branch are. What he thinks or doesn't think is certainly something we can't, you know, speculate about. But this performance is very clearly a very nominal, very ceremonial, very subdued performance. There's not even an effort to sort of do anything beyond that. I know that several people in op-eds have sort of urged him to say, you know, you're a judge, then, you know, go out there and judge. And John Roberts, just to add to I think the very right thing that you said about him being sort of in this unique position of being seen as somewhat independent, he's occupied that place since Kennedy's retirement, which plunged us into the Brett Kavanaugh debacle.
Yeah.
And since then, there's been this concern. Not that Kennedy was a centrist,
he was a conservative justice too.
He was a conservative who had a warm place in his heart for people who had real plights, like prisoners. You know, the famous case about California prison healthcare and the like. And I think to some extent, his stepping out has led to some people kind of moving a little bit into that spot. So we've seen, for example, Neil Gorsuch step into the shoes of Justice Scalia a little bit and being, yes, he is conservative, but at the same time, there's concerns there about privacy of citizens and over-criminalization that made Scalia not kind of like a typical conservative judge. We're seeing maybe a similar move with Roberts moving into the place that Kennedy used to occupy. And it's anyone's guess what this would look like if, you know, Kennedy or somebody else were presiding over this trial, whether they would adopt the same kind of very deferential, very ceremonial, very subdued performance.
Well, do you think that John Roberts has stepped into that position, or has that position become what John Roberts represents? Like, maybe the center is more conservative.
Right. That's a good point. I mean, the whole court has just taken a couple of steps to the right. And so whoever's on the right now, whoever used to be on the right is now in the center. So that's some of this. But we did see some independent, interesting decision making, which implies that he's not just kind of like being played by the political currents, but he actually is an independent thinker. I think some of the people who wrote op-eds about this yesterday that I saw were urging him to sort of channel that spirit a little bit more in the course of this trial, but he's probably concerned about exactly what you said about the repercussions of sort of creating a bad look for Senate Republicans by putting them in a position of overruling his decisions.
Yeah, that's interesting. Of course, we don't know the answer.
We
won't. Yeah. Just one last thing about what Senator Brown said in that clip, that the funds eventually were. The military aid was sent to Ukraine, so that's not such a big deal. However, last week Government Accountability Office, sort of a watchdog in Congress, had actually did its own report, its own investigation, and said that the Office of Management and Budget actually had violated the law by withholding that funds, because it said you can only withhold the funds if it was for programmatic issues. In other words, meaning maybe some things aren't met up to standard, maybe some things that need to happen haven't happened. Instead, this was policy reasons that the aid was not sent. And you cannot do that. It's a violation of the Impoundment Act, Control Act of 1974. And when we talk about that, now there's no real penalty that exists for violating that law. But it made me think about the term and what the crimes are that merit impeachment. Made me think, and we never talk about, we always talk about high crimes, we never talk about misdemeanors. And it kind of made me think, well, maybe this is the misdemeanor or something like this.
There's lots of ways to take this to sort of try and, if not actually prove a full-fledged crime, but at least rely on sort of criminal principles. I mean, the argument that there wasn't an effort to do this because it was ultimately unsuccessful is like basically saying that if you have people planning this big heist of a bank and they get caught the second before they rob the bank, you can't charge them with anything because the crime was not successful. That sort of only successful criminals are the ones that get tried, and if you get away with it, then it isn't a crime. In other words, the get away with it isn't a crime has been sort of a motto of this administration since the beginning, and we're seeing the same sort of another incarnation of this argument here. Well, ultimately everything was fine, except it wasn't fine. Because of all the things that this exposed about the way that this administration works.
Hadar, I'm going to invite some of our listeners to participate in our conversation. The phone number to have questions or comments. We want to make sure it's kept on impeachment. We welcome your comments, whatever they may be. Of course, we want to keep it respectful as well. Is 1-800-958-9008. 1-800-958-9008. 9008. And I do want to ask you, if you do get through, and I hope you will try to get to you, to try to make it as concise as possible. Oftentimes we get a lot of people on the line, and if we, if we're fumbling around and giving a lot of background to what we want to say, may not get time to actually get to other folks. So try to be as concise as you can. Look, I get it. They're probably saying, well, we want you to be more concise too, Mitch. Fair point. I will take it. Hadar Avram, I do want to go to another clip, and I want to listen to some Republicans again, because in the end, it kind of depends on what Republicans are saying, and we're going to be looking to see if there's any openness at all. And so we're going to go to Republican Senator Joni Ernst of Iowa. This is just after the break began.
This has been a very interesting few days that we have had on the floor of the Senate. And I'm going to start the discussion this evening because there are some interesting points that have been brought up that really resonate with me as a veteran and as someone who has special interests in Ukraine. Now, in 1989, as a young woman, I attended an agricultural exchange in Ukraine, 1989, while it was part of the former Soviet Union. Now, because of that exchange, I do have some interesting thoughts about Ukraine and how they wanted to be a free and independent nation at that time. And of course, a couple years after that, they did become a free and independent nation. What I find very interesting now is that the House managers are very, very centered on the fact that Russia was invading Ukraine and military funding to Ukraine. When did Russia roll their tanks into Crimea? That was 2014. Obama administration. How did the Obama administration react to that invasion of Ukraine? They reacted by sending blankets. Blankets don't throw lead downrange. This administration, President Trump, provided lethal aid to the Ukrainian people, actually allowed them an opportunity to defend themselves. The House Democrats, these House managers, did nothing of the sort to provide that assistance to Ukraine. And yet now they are on their high horse about President Trump not doing enough for Ukraine. This administration has done more than the previous administration did when Crimea was being invaded. I have very strong thoughts about that. So, as we are being lectured by the House managers about how they are such great friends to Ukraine, got a little information. This year's National Defense Authorization Act, the conference report, which included lethal aid to Ukraine, House Manager Nadler voted no. Last year's National Defense Authorization Act, which included lethal aid to Ukraine, House Managers Lofgren, Jeffries, and Nadler voted no.
So that's Republican Senator Joni Ernst of Iowa, joined here in the studio by Hadar Avram. Interesting, when we first started hearing this clip, I was like, whoa, I wonder where this is going to go, you know, talking about her connection to Ukraine. Your reaction to what you heard from her?
More obfuscation that has nothing to do with a point.
Yeah.
That's basically what's
Is
going
that it?
On.
Very good. Let's go to some callers. We do have callers on the line. And again, the number to give us a call is 1-800-958-9008. 1-800-958-9008. Going to go to the first caller, Greg in Mariposa. Good afternoon, Greg. You are on the air.
Yeah, hi. It's Craig, actually.
Oh, sorry.
I
Craig.
Responded.
Craig, I got it, Craig.
Okay. So I have two very particular points I want to get into. Following up on what we were just hearing about obfuscation about Ukraine, the Republicans keep bringing up over and over, well, if there's going to be witnesses, we want to bring in none other than Hunter Biden. Now, here's the
Oh, Craig, you were just getting into your point, too, sir. Okay. Let's pretend as though we knew what Craig was going to say. And, Craig, try to get your call back in. Don't know what happened. 1-800-958-9008. Relevancy concerning witnesses. And Democrats say that Hunter Biden is not a relevant witness. We've heard reports that the Republicans were floating this deal that, okay, tell you what, we'll give you John Bolton, we get Hunter Biden. Democrats say, well, that's not relevant. We're not going to ever go for that deal. Republicans respond to that by saying, well, wait a minute, you were charging the president with fraudulently investigating Hunter Biden. Of course, the president's team says it was a valid investigation. Why wouldn't Hunter Biden be relevant to the case?
Well, for one thing, we've had evidence in the impeachment inquiry pointing to the fact that the president was not actually seeking an investigation of the Bidens. He was only seeking a public declaration on the part of the Ukrainians that they were looking into the matter so that that would be a soundbite that Hannity could later play on Fox News. So that means that what was actually going on in terms of the Bidens is completely irrelevant to what's going on. What was going on was the pressure on the Ukrainians to say that that was what they were going to do, which is the point the Democrats are trying to make. The point the Republicans are trying to make, of course, and again, this is, as Craig said, in the spirit of obfuscation and talking about other things, is to draw the conversation toward the Bidens, which has been a Republican talking point all along, even during the inquiry, that there was a lot of effort to sort of push it in that direction. And all you need to say really is Biden and corruption in the same sentence, and Hannity has a whole hour worth of material to play with, which is really the goal of getting this centered in the conversation.
And it's something I've very much watch. I've noticed as I've watched Fox News, and you see it happening as I observe these hearings happening live. They get their 5 minutes in the House of Representatives when each member had 5 minutes. That was their time to create the soundbite that was going to be used later on to paint the picture of what, you know, what happened.
Exactly. And I can't emphasize this enough. What we're seeing is performative efforts to get material that is later going to matter in the election. That is the purpose of this.
Yeah.
On both sides, really.
Yeah. Yeah. No, of course. Of course. And then I guess that's the question. Is the Senate on trial here?
I guess depends on who's doing the judging.
Are Republicans on trial here? I mean, I don't know what's going to happen. I didn't think Donald Trump was going to win in 2016. So I'm very cautious on how confident I am and how things are going to go. But I could see a scenario where this actually can wreck the party. That there could be the chickens coming home to roost, I guess, or a reckoning for the party.
Depending on who is listening and what conclusions they're going to draw. And a lot of that depends on what TV channel they're watching this on.
Yeah, that's the thing right there. Yeah, exactly. Let's go to Peter in Mill Valley. Good afternoon, Peter. You are on the air.
Oh, good. Yes. There were a number of points I just wanted to make. I think, first of all, and I'll try and do it really quickly. I think what stands out for me is, certainly from the Democrat point of view, how very clear and how they've been building these foundational building blocks in getting across their whole point. And I've sort of been very impressive to see the whole process. This is how the Constitution is working to a certain extent. I think what is pretty unfortunate is that the degree to which Mitch McConnell is manipulating it in, I think, a really quite destructive manner. Secondly, I would say that in the Intelligence Committee, I thought the best part for me was the basis from the legal perspective of the nature of the charges, laying it out very clearly and very precisely. I think this is what really stands out, is how the legal aspect and presentation of this impeachment inquiry protest has taken place. And I think what it's for us is learning the process, how the process of the Senate and both the Congress has been working step by step. And, of course, there's been great obfuscation, and that has been really quite clear from the Republican side, particularly Mitch McConnell. I'm uncomfortable with the subject. And I think there should have been many more charges brought in terms of the impeachment, personally. And I'm uncomfortable about the whole basis of the charge of with Ukraine, because, and I think you agree from what I heard from you, is that it's an unfortunate case where here we're giving money to a country which is in the process of civil war. Anyway, apart from all that, I wanted to make a kind of a historical parallel. I don't think it's too much of a stretch to compare what is taking place now with the Senate, Congress, and the Constitution and the Republic, to go as far as to say it is very similar, I think, crossing the Rubicon and setting in process really the final destruction of the Senate, which was corrupt by that time, which eventually led to one-man rule, meaning the emperor of Rome. And I think it's a very, very, very dangerous time. In fact, how is very much how the Constitution is being put on the line. And it also shows to what extent there is integrity in the Senate. And if Trump gets in, if Trump goes towards the next election, I am really doubtful that the Democrats will actually get in. The nature of the times is one of rapid and startling breakdown of structures and structures throughout the country and political systems. And I think this might lead to it.
All right, Peter. Appreciate your call. Good call, Peter. Thank you for Mill Valley. So you nodding a lot there.
Yeah, one thing that I think you said, Peter, that I think is really interesting is the idea of how what a clear narrative we're getting from the essentially prosecution here. And some commentators have pointed out that that may be why Nancy Pelosi was delaying bringing the charges to the Senate, partly to allow them to prepare this narrative. And there's a lot of choices to be made, right? Because again, you can tell the story with a lot of details, you can tell the story with little details, you have a lot of, you have your pick of clips to use and what not to use. So you, and because we're essentially producing performative sound bites, we have to tell the story in a way that is going to be most convincing and compelling for the people who are on the fence.
And I think Peter knows that I appreciated his comment about the Rubicon. I'm always an enthusiast when it comes to classical history and, you know, basically Rome going from what historians would consider a republic to an empire. Earlier today, we were speaking to Karen Greenberg of Fordham University, who also teaches law, and we're kind of talking about this idea of an imperial presidency. And it doesn't begin with Donald Trump. This is something that has been in the making for decades now, which the president obtains more and more power, that Congress sort of relinquishes a lot of its power, and then it's taken up by the president. And here we are in a situation with this impeachment. And in some ways, you know, if we look at it this way, you can't, you know, according to the Justice Department, this is a longstanding opinion, you can't indict a president.
By the way, I should chime in that this Department of Justice policy is hotly debated among constitutional scholars.
As to whether or not you can.
Right. Yeah. So when the Mueller report came out, there were a number of people saying, well, who says that you can't indict a sitting president?
Yeah.
But that has been a fairly consistent opinion of the DOJ, and Mueller saw himself as a good soldier. And
he followed it. And this goes back to Watergate time.
Exactly.
And you're right. It's just a DOJ opinion. It's not a Supreme Court decision or anything, so that could change. But as it is now, it's pretty it has been generally accepted, but maybe not within the constitutional debates that you're around, that you can't indict a president. A president, you can't compel the president to hand over information in the impeachment inquiry. And it's not personal information we're even talking about here. We're not even talking about his personal tax records. We're not talking about his financial records. We're talking about government information. We're talking about government officials. Can't compel the president to do that. And then perhaps you can't even impeach the president.
Yeah, this is complicated. And there is a line of cases going back to the Framers' day trying to deal with all kinds of situations like that. There's so the Constitution guarantees everybody a right to something called compulsory process in criminal trials, which is that you can use the court subpoena power to try and get the other party to give you information that's good for your case. The defendant, of course, in criminal cases. And there's this famous case involving, of all people, Aaron Burr. So Aaron Burr, who many of our musical fans listening to this remember from, you know, killing Hamilton in a duel, was also involved in a really bizarre ploy to overthrow the American government. And was mixed in with another character by the name of General Wilkinson. And Wilkinson eventually ended up changing alliances and sort of, you know, teaming up with Jefferson. And Burr was put on trial for treason. And Burr claimed that he wanted the president to bring forth all kinds of information that the president had. And John Marshall, who was not only a really interesting Supreme Court justice, but also a clever political operative, was sort of, again, protecting Jefferson and saying, you know, the privilege is not really his. It's his attorney's, and the attorney has the documents, and somehow managed to avoid all that. Burr ended up getting acquitted of the charges. So really a remarkable. So like if you think we live in interesting times now, you know, those were interesting times too. So yes, there has been this constant constitutional reticence about requiring the White House to come forward with information. But of course, in when you're dealing with people who see the welfare of the country ahead of them, partly this is because this stuff could be sensitive to national security, not because you're trying to cover your own ass, which is a completely different ballgame.
Right. That is the voice of Hadar Avaram, who's a professor of law at the University of California Hastings College of the Law, where she co-directs the Hastings Institute for Criminal Justice and publishes the California Correctional Crisis blog. Her latest book is called Yesterday's Monsters, the Manson Family Cases and the Illusion of Parole. We are going to take a quick musical break, and when we come back, we have more callers on the line. Again, earlier, Craig and Mariposa, I'm sorry we lost you, but if you want to try to get in and get a call, the number is 1-800-958-9008, 1-800-958-9008. We'll be right back. Pianist Keith Jarrett. You are listening to live coverage of the Senate impeachment trial of President Donald J. Trump. I'm Rich, coming to you from the studios of KPFA. We are also joined by Hadar Avaram, professor of law at the University of California Hastings College of the Law. Great opportunity, actually, legal-based questions concerning impeachment in, because Hadar has been kind enough to stay with us until the top of the hour. At the top of the hour, you will get Flashpoint, Ms. Bernstein, and then at 6 p.m., you will have the KPFA Evening News. We'll be back tomorrow at 1 p.m., will be the third day of oral arguments by the House Democratic managers. So before we dive back into all of these questions, I do again want to urge you, if you can, as I pass the hat around, to ask you to donate what you can so that we can make these broadcast of impeachment process possible. Again, it's something we hadn't budgeted for. It does take resources. We are doing it on a shoestring budget. This isn't actual regular, you know, this is not a fun drive. There's not a goal we have to make. There's not a challenge we have to make. Basically, I'm just passing the hat around that if you appreciate having a place, a trusted place where you can listen to the impeachment trial occur, which in fact I think is actually easier to listen to it than necessarily to watch it. You can have it in the background. Do whatever you like. If you want to make sure that we can stay together with KPFA during this impeachment trial, I'm going to ask you to make a contribution of, you know, what you can afford, what is according to your own means, what you will feel good about. The way you can make that contribution is 1-800-439-5732. 1-800-439-5732 or online at kpfa.org. Again, we're just trying to raise a little bit of money during these broadcasts so that we can cover the costs of bringing you the Senate impeachment trial and the analysis and guests you mostly only get on KPFA. So again, that phone number is 1-800-439-5732. 1-800-439-5732 or online apfa.org. All right, Hadar, thank you for your patience. Let's get back to some listener questions here as we are down to our sort of like last 24 minutes or so of our broadcast. And we're going to go to, Ethan in San Francisco. Ethan's been very patient, so I thank you for that. Ethan, you're on the air. Good afternoon.
Oh, hey, Mitch, it's Stephen. I'm not sure I'm
Stephen.
On. Stephen. Me?
All right.
That's all right.
Things get lost in translation around here.
That's all right. That's all right.
Because you're on the air, Stephen.
So I wanted to get you and your guest's perspective. I've been attorney for 30 years, and what actually offends me the most is the Article 2 of the impeachment in terms of just the wholesale obstruction of Congress's constitutional right to conduct an impeachment inquiry. I mean, even Richard Nixon, you know, my recollection is that the third article of his impeachment was for contempt of Congress for good reason, and yet even he, you know, didn't not provide documents. John Dean was counsel testified. Former Attorney General testified. H.R. Haldeman, his chief of staff, testified. Had ever been such a wholesale obstruction of the Congress's and the House of Representatives' constitutional right to conduct an impeachment as we're seeing with us? Because I haven't seen this.
All right. Appreciate your call. Stephen in San Francisco, I don't think this has ever happened.
No, I don't think so either. I mean, again, plenty of things to get outraged about. And the obstruction of justice that Stephen was mentioning is actually ongoing throughout the whole time, because the refusals to introduce witnesses at this stage is just a continuation of what the White House did in the inquiry phase. And it's done completely in concert with the White House. So, we weren't dealing with this kind of individual before.
Yeah. And just the irony of hearing Republican senators say, I haven't heard anything new. Well, yes. Yeah, because you're not allowing anything new to be presented.
Yeah, it's difficult. You know, I'm sitting here, you know, thinking about this and opining about this. And I think we're all, you know, just a little bit short of primal scream therapy. But the times are not normal. The situation is not normal. The people we're dealing with are not normal. And this is what it is.
I'm with Stephen about. I'm really interested in the second article of impeachment concerning obstruction of Congress.
And by the way, this makes me think of the fact that even in the Mueller report, where they stopped short of the collusion stuff, of the kind of conspiracy charges, saying, you know, they were grateful recipients, but they were not co-conspirators, largely because they were not sophisticated enough to be co-conspirators. They actually did find that in 5 out of the 10 instances of obstruction of that they looked at, there was obstruction of justice. It's always, and this goes back, of course, to the sort of the classic Nixon cliche, right, that the cover-up is always worse than the crime. But the cover-up is so bumbling and clumsy that it's also easier to see than the crime. So if there's a debate here about kind of like the aid, it was released, it was not released. If anything should tip us to the fact that there's something wrong going on, it's just the extent and the amateurish nature of the cover-up.
Yeah, I'm somebody who follows government and I like how government works. I actually don't like elections. I don't like covering elections because I feel like they're vapid and everyone's promising everything. You never really know what's going to happen. But I like how government works. I like following what agencies do, how legislation works, and how oversight works. I like following the checks and balances between the three branches of the government. And often I keep asking myself, and I think what's important, as crazy as this moment is right now or has been for these past 3 years, for me, the bigger question is what do things look like after this moment passes? What are the precedents that will create new realities in the future? And I just can't help that if this complete obstruction is successful, what kind of precedence that's going to create?
Well, for one thing, the 2020 election is going to break records of vapid if we're talking about elections being vapid. And we're going to, of course, you know, since we're essentially rewarding foreign interference, we're not going to see appropriate protections against it, because the people in charge of the protections have no interest to provide the protections. So there is a lot to be very, very worried about, which is why I want to say to everybody listening who's just feeling so apathetic about the whole thing, and I know that there's this fatigue that comes with how psychologically burdensome it is to be engaged in this process, please do not stop staying engaged, because that is how elections get lost, when the public stops paying attention.
And I'm not saying I don't think elections are important. I'm just saying I don't like covering
elections as much.
I like covering government. But no, obviously elections are very important. And we saw what happened in the last election. Let's go to our next caller. And we're going to go to Lake Tahoe, where we are joined by G.S. Good afternoon, G.S. Appreciate you being holding on the line. You are on the air.
Yes, it's quite all right. Can you hear me okay?
Yes, you can.
All right, excellent. I would like to read one sentence from the official Senate rules for a trial, and then I'd like to discuss briefly Mitch McConnell and his influence on all of this. Okay, and we've heard this on air, but this is the source. I'm sorry, this is the oath according to the official Senate rules for a trial, and I'm just going to read this one sentence. This is for all the members of the Senate, and that's read by, the Chief Justice at the very beginning. I solemnly swear that in all things appertaining to the trial of the impeachment of President Donald J. Trump, now pending, I will do impartial justice according to the Constitution and laws. So help me God. Okay, so that's the oath of impartiality. It's binding on all the members of the Senate. So that's, and is the name? I'm not sure it is or not, but, there's penalties, severe penalties, prison possibly, if they don't do that. But, let that slide. This is the oath that all of them are taking as members of the Senate to participate in this whole exercise. Now, so that thing. The second is Mitch McConnell, and I think he's the linchpin, and an awful lot of what is going on in this entire term of this chaotic person who happens to be the current occupant of the Oval Office. And that's McConnell, who held up, basically tabled the nomination of Merrick Garland to the Supreme Court. He held that up for almost a year. And, technically, he has the power to do that, but I thought it was unrighteous. But right now, in just the last few days, he has managed to table every single motion put on the floor of the Senate, which appertained to the permission for documents and witnesses to speak in the context of all of this. He has the legal power to do that, but he didn't have to, but he did. Incredibly good tactician. But Mitch McConnell has basically stopped things in midair. And I think later, a couple days from now, there may be, I think I've heard this, that the witnesses and the documents may be allowed. But anyway, those are my comments. Oath of impartiality, binding on all the senators, and the power of Mitch McConnell to throw an absolute wrench into this whole process of government.
All right, GS, good call. Appreciate the call from Lake Tahoe.
So I'm glad we're talking a little bit about Mitch McConnell, because he's sort of been hovering in the background of all these like unsavory phenomena that we're talking about. And I'm also really glad that you pointed out the Merrick Garland incident, because that was just the hallmark of like the Mitch McConnell phenomenon, right? Which is just this breathtaking combination of just absolute amorality and just like utter lack of shame. Just like he's just there isn't even a veneer that there's some sort of like higher.
I think he enjoys it.
Higher constant, but he's very open with the fact that he enjoys it and that he does it because it is a tactic that helps his side win. He's very open about it. He doesn't see anything wrong with it. It's for people who expect at least a veneer of kind of like efforts at deniability. It's breathtaking to see. It's like a new generation of politician that is just like out there saying, I'm a politician. I don't really care about the country. I don't care about the public good. The only thing I care about is that my side wins, and I'm going to do everything within my power to do it. And there's brilliant gamesmanship, of course, that goes into it. The stolen Supreme Court seat was evidence of that, and we've seen plenty of examples of that. And just like the shameless open public collusion with the White House about what shape this trial was going to take.
Yeah.
Just not even an effort to kind of, try and hide it.
Like you kind of knew, but
you kind of knew, but it's like they're just doing it in your face.
Like it's just it's just what GS brought up about the oath of impartiality that the senators take.
And this is what it means to have people, I don't even want to say immoral, because I think amoral captures more what's going on. People who are completely self-interested and they don't care. They know there aren't going to be repercussions and they don't care.
I heard, I think this might have come from Lawrence Lessig, an idea that maybe Chuck Schumer early on in the trial should have brought a motion to remove Mitch McConnell and other senators who have already expressed strong opinions as they had in this opinion, because it goes against the oath of impartiality. Now, it wasn't going to happen. It wasn't going to succeed. But what it would have done was probably force a debate just to further bring the attention to that issue.
It's possible, although it's kind of hard to see how this would be far from anyone's attention because it's front and center the whole time. But keep in mind that also, like in terms of the tactics on the Democratic side, keep in mind that there's also this idea that on one hand you want to win, and on the other hand your win to some extent hangs on the linchpin of kind of like the Michelle Obama, when they go low, we go high sort of thing. So maybe there's part of that going on. You saw some of this play out in Adam Schiff's sort of introduction to the whole process in the very first day when he said, you know, this is how proper trials go. Sort of, I'm appealing to your better selves. You know, he knows there's no better selves to appeal to, but he's doing it nonetheless because presumably the trademark of this side of the debate is going to be kind of like the we're taking the high road. And I think that reasonable people can differ on whether that's a good strategy or not.
We've got about 10 minutes remaining in this broadcast. We're going to try to get through as many callers as we can. If you want to try to get on, though, I don't know if we'll have time to get to you, but you never know. The number is 1-800-958-9008, 1-800-958-9008. Again, if we could raise a little bit of money, we would be able to continue to do these broadcasts over the next few weeks, and so we'd have more opportunities to call in the days to come as well. Let's go to Paul, who is in Oakland. Paul, thank you for your patience. Good afternoon. You're on the air.
Good afternoon, and thank you to Pacifica, to KPFA, to the hosts, and to the guests for this coverage.
Thank you, Paul.
My comment connects with the guest's comments on gamemanship, and in particular, I've noticed that there's absolutely no media coverage on any of the media outlets about this next point, and that is the Clinton impeachment process has been brought up umpteen number of times, every hour, every day, but only in the context of rules. The substance, the subject, or the justification for invoking the impeachment process is never brought up. And I think that's something that's really stark in its absence. In this country, there was a sense of, is this a proper use of this power and a proper use of this time? And there are critics right now of this process are bringing that up about why are we doing this? This is a sham. This shouldn't be happening. But no one's necessarily talking about or hearkening back to the most recent impeachment process, in which a Republican House and a Republican Senate brought a president, a U.S. president, through the impeachment process, in essence, because they had an extramarital affair. Now, in point of fact, it was because the president lied under oath, but it was lying under oath about an extramarital affair.
And also tampered with witnesses. I'm sorry, Paul, go ahead. I'm not trying to interrupt you. Go ahead.
No, well, my point is that there's zero conversation about the substance of the subject or the context or the gravity of the charges and the context in which impeachment is invoked. And so if you take that situation where you have lying under oath about an extramarital affair, potential tampering with witnesses, and you weigh that against obstructing Congress and inviting or working to compel a foreign nation to become active in U.S. politics and in the U.S. political process and election, I think that's something that the general population would have feelings about, but there's no conversation about it and there's no context provided.
All right.
And any media outlet.
Good call, Paul. Thank you for that. It's interesting, Hadar. Republicans have talked about the 1999 impeachment as in justifying, as in even setting the standard for what you should impeach a president for, saying that Bill Clinton broke the law. He lied under oath, and he also tampered with witnesses. And it's a bit of a complicated case, the 1999 one, if you go back and look at it.
And you can see how very different values inform the two views on this, right? Because there is a view that says, well, here's a person who broke a law, and here's a person where you're bringing up these vague abuse of powers thing. And then there's the other side saying, well, this is about an extramarital affair, and this is about inviting a foreign country to intervene in your elections.
Yeah.
So there's two different perspectives. I suspect, Paul, that the Clinton thing might become more of an issue when the defense side of the trial comes, and just because Ken Starr is now involved in Trump's defense, so that might become a friend of mine made a quip the other day. It's now going to be an all-star cast. So when Ken Starr comes into it, we'll see how much they want to put him in the limelight and how much they think it serves or doesn't serve their case to sort of have this visual reminder of the Clinton impeachment out there, of course, from the other side. But there was some conversation about kind of like the appropriateness of impeachment, specifically from Jonathan Turley. So when they brought up the four law professors at the impeachment inquiry, so three of my colleagues testified, you know, of course, that this should be grounds for impeachment. If this is not impeachable, then what is? Jonathan Turley didn't try to argue, you know, the evidence is worth nothing or what have you. What he tried to say is, people are channeling their feelings of anger to this, and it's sort of an inappropriate use of impeachment. Many of us were a little puzzled by this view because I was like, well, the problem is not that we're angry instead of, you know, looking at the substance. We are angry precisely because we've looked at the substance and it's upsetting us, right? But that's exactly the point Turley was trying to make, is like, you know, this is not a, like, if you are outraged, channel your outrage toward the electoral process. Don't go through with this. That's the point he was trying to make. It's very difficult to make little of these charges, but we're sure going to see people try in the next few days.
Yeah. I'm going to try to get through as many calls as we can now, as we're down to probably our last 6 minutes in this broadcast. And I think we have Craig back. Is that correct? Did Craig? All right, well, let's get to Craig, because we dropped him before, and then right after that, Mark, you're next. So be ready, sir. You know, no delay. Let's go to Craig. Craig, appreciate you calling back.
Hi, yeah, thanks that you got me back. And you know, by the way, I have to say, I for one do appreciate hearing your old stories from Capitol Hill. But
well, thank you, Craig.
But anyway,
that's why I brought you back. I could tell you were friendly right from the get go. I was like, don't let this guy go. Anyways, Craig, yeah. We only got a couple of moments, though.
I know. Let me quickly wrap up the first thing. You got the basic idea, but what before I get to the set, my other point that I want to bring up on calling Hunter Biden as a witness. What I wanted your guest to comment on briefly, please, is, isn't this precisely where John Roberts should step in and say, this witness that you want to call is completely non-germane. He has nothing to do with the charges against Trump, and I will not allow that. And then, you know, force a ruling or force him to override it, perhaps. But that's what I wanted to get to. John Roberts should take a stand on that very narrow issue.
All right,
and
Craig.
You want the other thing for me first before you answer that?
Yep.
Okay, so the other thing is about, well, funny what you were just talking about, the issue of, well, does there need to be a crime for the president to be charged? Now, back in 1998, Alan Dershowitz, who now is saying, oh, there must be a crime charged, in 1998 when it was Clinton, he was interviewed by CNN, and he said, there doesn't need to be a crime. This made headlines all over the place. Did you see any of those headlines?
Oh, yeah. And then he's been asked about it. He says, I'm just more he says, I wasn't wrong then. I just have more of a fuller opinion about it because I'm now more informed. Craig,
but he's the guy that they're going to rely on to make the case for that, which is ridiculous.
Yeah. And we'll probably see it probably Monday or Tuesday. I don't think you'll see it on Saturday. He was he's not going to be there the whole time, but I think we'll see him early next week. Thanks for the call, Craig. Did you want to say anything about that?
Yeah. So I really appreciate, Craig, the point about if there's any like obvious place for John Roberts to step in, it's about Hunter Biden. And this is exactly the sort of the debate that we talked about before, which is like assuming, which is what we know, that the Senate Republicans want to shift the conversation to the Bidens for a variety of reasons that serve their electoral purposes to sort of make that the center of gravity of the conversation. On one hand, the obvious situation for the Chief Justice to chime in and say this evidence is not probative, it's not relevant. This is kind of like the minimum that a judge does in a normal trial. On the other hand, to run afoul of them on this point that is very, very central to their base and their messaging is going to put them in a light that's not flattering, that might later reflect poorly on him as being their adversary. And I'm sure that's, I mean, this is partly why we have live appointments to the Supreme Court. And nonetheless, people are worried about sort of running afoul in this very public way.
Okay, we have time for one last call. It's going to be Mark in Novato. Mark, appreciate your patience. You're on the air.
Okay, in 60 seconds or less, it's clear that the first words of the Constitution are "we the people." Secondary, it's also clear since the rise of the Unitary Executive and the Patriot Act and the subsequent abdication of power by Congress over to the executive through the war powers, that the people are left with no remedy. We are now at the point where the people's remedy must come into play. So my question for the legal scholar is, under what basis could we cover law by legal notification for the forcible removal of Congress and the president?
You mean just get rid of Congress?
I mean people going there and taking everyone out of the building by force of arms, and under what level could we come? Could we say to them under legal terms, you are about to have this happen. We are not committing an act. We are exercising our rights under the Constitution as we the people because you have failed to act according to what our expectations are.
All right, Mark. Thank you for that. Hadar, to me, that sounds like an armed revolution.
Yeah, I mean, I can empathize with the despair that's underlying this idea. I obviously am not going to advocate for it, but I am going to say that there is a way for we the people to have their mark, and that is for every single person who is listening to the show to vote, to encourage other people to vote, to donate, to volunteer, and to do the real thing that we the people can do. Remove these people from office in 2020. We can do it. If we shake up the despair and the apathy, it is possible. It happened in 2018, and it can happen again in 2020. Do not lose hope.
But I think Mark felt very strongly about that.
Well, what I'm saying is that you don't really need arms for it. What we need is to go as one to the ballot box to make sure that everybody who is allowed to vote legally actually vote. And there's plenty we can do to ensure that before November.
And I'm just playing, Hadar. Thank you. Hadar Avaram has been our guest, professor of law at the University of California Hastings College of Law, where she co-directs the Hastings Institute for Criminal Justice and publishes the California Correctional Crisis blog. Her latest book is called Gay's Monsters, The Manson Family Cases and the Illusion of Parole. You're going to have an event in March in San Francisco.
Yes, the book release party is going to be on March 11th, which is a Wednesday night, March 11th at 7 p.m. at Manny's on 16th and Valencia in San Francisco. And I hope to see many of you there trying to think about how to reform our broken parole system.
Well, Hadar Avaram, I thought this really worked out. I enjoyed our time together and taking
calls. So did
calls.
I. Thank you
Thank you for being here. And thank you. Friends, today's coverage was produced by Deanna Martinez. At the controls is Kyle Gustafson. Production assistance provided by Jean Froggy, Scott Baba, and Tanea Lance. Special thank you to Operations Engineering Department, Antonio Ortiz and Brian David, and to the news department's Eileen Alfandary. Again, broadcasts like these are only possible because of your financial support. We weren't able to get to all the callers, but we can keep taking calls in the, a few weeks ahead as we go through this impeachment trial. Just ask in to donate what you can so that we could do these broadcasts. The number is 1-800-439-5732, 1-800-439-5732, or online at kpfa.org. I'm Mitch Jezrich. Hope you'll join us tomorrow.
has just published a new book, Understanding Socialism. It destroys false narratives, confronts historic failures, reveals the way to a fresh socialism based on workplace democracy. Cornel West says Wolf's new book is the most accessible, reliable treatment we have of what socialism is, was, should be. Laura Sanders says it explains socialism in a way that's not only smart, but makes the rest of us feel smart. Chris Hedges says Wolf provides a sane and just socialist alternative to capitalist exploitation. Richard Wolf will discuss this new book Friday evening, February 28th at First Church, Berkeley, 2407 Dana Street. There's wheelchair access. Sabrina Jacobs will host this benefit for KPFA and Democracy at Work. Tickets at brownpapertickets.com or supportive bookstores.
KPFA, KPFB, Berkeley, 88.1 KFCF in Fresno, 97.K248 BR in Santa Cruz, and online at kpfa.org.
From the studios of KPFA in Berkeley, California,